Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Buzzkillers, 1870 to 1940s, fascinating period in American history. First of all, industrialization's in high gear. There's a spread of railroads and telegraph lines. There's a great increase in mass media via newspapers. An increased concentration on charisma, magnetism, and emotion in politics, in religion, and social reform. But Professor, you're saying, what a rise in charisma, rise in emotion, rise in magnetism? You never talk like that. What does all that mean? Those are sort of emotional things. Well, fortunately, Professor Jeremy Young is here to tell us all about his fascinating new work on this very misunderstood topic. Professor, how are you?
Doing pretty well. How are you?
It's great to hear you all the way over the internets.
Yes, I know. It's wonderful to be here from sunny Utah, which actually isn't very sunny right now.
Isn't it? So. Oh, well, we shouldn't give out your location. Remember, we have serious problems with strategic planning. We have to have anti-aircraft guns here at the Institute. And I know that people who disagree with you historiographically and disagree with your interpretation are going to try to seek you out.
I'm shaking my shoes.
Good. all those people who want to emphasize just plain facts and no emotion. Fortunately, Buzzkillers, Professor Young has just published a new book called The Age of Charisma, Leaders, Followers, and Emotions in American Society, 1870 to 1940, just come out from Cambridge University Press, and it's absolutely fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came onto this subject? What prompted you to examine it?
Absolutely. Well, like a lot of history buffs, I was fascinated as a kid with presidents. I thought Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson were really interesting guys. I read their speeches. I thought they were really emotional and moving. And as I embarked on a career as a historian, I decided that I wanted to know more than just why they what they were saying, but why they were so emotional and moving to me, to others, and to people in their own time period. And so that got me looking at leadership and at emotions in the Gilded Age and Progressive Era. And at, just the way that people responded to these incredibly emotional speakers.
Right. We should remind Buzzkillers that the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era is exactly the time period we're talking about, especially 1870 to about 1930, right?
So the Gilded Age is about 1870s-ish to the late 1900. And the Progressive Era, they overlap a little bit. You could say the Progressive Era starts in 1890, runs until maybe the early 1920s.
And one of the reasons I think this makes such a good topic for our show is that, people complain today about packaged politicians. People are always, they're overly schooled. They're being taught how to speak. They're being taught elocution, and everything is run through the advertising agency and all that sort of stuff. And people often argue, we should have it back like when they were all natural, like Teddy Roosevelt and all those other people. And you argue quite convincingly in your book that, well, no, they actually consciously went after this sort of approach.
Oh, there was nothing natural about it. These people were learning this stuff in textbooks in their college classes. They were learning how to talk in ways that were moving and emotional to audiences. One of the things that I discovered is that a lot of the most famous charismatic speakers from this time period all studied out of the same textbook. And that's the reason that they were so emotionally moving to their audiences.
Oh, how interesting. I had no idea. That's absolutely fascinating. Can you give us some background and sort of trajectory of what's going on that leads up to this? What's happening during this period that helps this lay the groundwork for these sorts of innovations?
Well, a lot of interesting things are happening in the late 1800s. I like to say that the late 1800s is the most important time in American history that we don't think of as an important time, because we know that the Civil War is important. We know that World War II, the 60s are important. But the late 1800s is really when America undergoes this huge shift in our economy. We basically go from, with a single generation, from being a country of farmers to a country of factories.
Yeah.
And that changes everything. It changes, it leaves a lot of people really unsettled, so that they're looking for this kind of emotional stimulation. It creates a national network of railroads so that charismatic speakers can travel all over the country for the first time and give the same speech, not just to a local audience, but all over everywhere. It changes people's attitudes toward whether we should be individualists who are just out for our own ends, or whether we should focus on the broader interests of the community. And yeah, it just changes, you know, basically everything about, it creates a religious awakening in the late 1800s, you know, these major religious movements get started. Just a huge series of upheavals that lead people to be more interested in this sort of connection with their political leaders. And the other thing that's happening, or that isn't happening, that we should actually talk about, is any connection at all up to the 1870s between politicians and ordinary voters. It was actually considered to be, you know, basically if you tried to campaign for office at all, or if you talked to a voter when running for president, you were seen as a demagogue.
As undignified.
Right. Well, not just as undignified, but, you know, you were trying to be influenced by the people. You shouldn't care what the people think. You should just, you know, you should govern according to your own best instincts. And so there was no connection at all between politicians, especially presidential-level politicians, and ordinary voters. And in this time period, people got tired of it.
And of course, up to, you know, the early 20th century, only men could vote. So,
right. Know, there were some states.
At least in major elections.
Right. Well, in the West, out here in Utah, for instance, women could vote starting in the early 1900s, before 1920. But for most of the country, no, they couldn't vote.
Okay, so it's more than just the fact that the country's expanding and things are sort of accelerating through industrialization and all these other things. It's as almost as if there's a reaction against that. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. People are unsettled by these huge changes. I mean, but before industrialization happens, people had been farmers for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, to just have that go away in a single generation is just – I think we underestimate how shocking that is to people. You know, just wake up one day and the world has changed in a way no humans have ever seen it change before.
In one lifetime.
It happens in one lifetime, really in a decade or two. And so you start looking for something to fill you emotionally because you feel like nothing makes any sense. You feel unrooted. You feel alienated.
Okay, that's one of the reasons why we see these great religious revivals, big, huge tent meetings. You know, people publish their sermons more and things like that you talk about extensively in the book, right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So what other sort of inspirations? We're talking about basically a change in rhetorical style for not only speakers, but kind of the whole approach about attracting people and attracting followers. What other inspirations were there for those kind of changes?
So the other major major change, I would say, has to do with the way public speaking is taught. Before the 1820s, if you wanted to learn to be a good public speaker, you simply memorized good public speeches. So people would sit around and memorize the speeches of Demosthenes or Cicero, and they would assume that these are very flowery speeches, they're very over the top, and they would assume that, you know, contained in the words of those speeches is some kind of magical advice about how to speak them. Never mind, of course, speeches were translated from the Greek and the Roman, the Latin. There's no way that this makes any sense.
Yeah.
And so this one guy changes all that. A guy named James Rush, whose father, Benjamin Rush, was a signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, James Rush is a medical doctor, and he basically is sitting around in his house. He writes about this at length, sitting around in his house saying, you know, I want to make the study of public speaking something that anyone can use on any text, not just these famous texts like Cicero, but anything. You can just sort of learn these speaking techniques, and you can speak in a way that is emotionally affecting to people. And so he sits
there.
In
theory, the phone book could become, even though they didn't have phone books then, but even in theory.
Oh, yeah. And he sits around in his house, and he spends basically several years just making noises to himself in the middle of the night to try to test out this new theory that he comes up with. My favorite story about this is, you know, his wife has no interest in the work that he's doing.
Right.
And so he doesn't have anybody to try these techniques out on. So at one point he goes down to the barn and he tries one of these vocal techniques out on his horses to see if it works. And it does. these are you know, equine tested vocal techniques. And he writes a book called The Philosophy of the Human Voice in 1827, and it becomes, in one form or another, the standard textbook in public speaking classes throughout the 1800s. What's interesting is that the real change doesn't happen for another 50 years, because people have to start learning this textbook in college, and then they have to grow up and become famous before the style really changes things.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. It's fascinating. But you say in the book, and it's quite convincing, that the charisma isn't just a better way to do speaking. It's a reaction against what looks like the over-organization, if you will, of society as the 1880s and 1890s and early 1900s roll around. It's almost as if people are saying we need to get emotion back in our lives and back in our society. We don't want to become automatons.
I think that's true. And I think in particular, it's just this feeling that, you know, the world is spinning out of control, and somehow not having a direct connection with the people who are running that world, with the leaders, seems unacceptable now to people. People didn't seem to mind when they, you know, couldn't go hear Andrew Jackson give a speech in the 1820s. They felt like they still knew him or still connected to him somehow. But in the 1870s and 80s and 90s, Americans just come to feel that they have to have this kind of connection with their leaders. And so charisma allows them to do this because these leaders are going around giving these speeches and attracting voters emotionally and not just, through their ideas, through their rhetoric. And that makes people feel like they have some stake in this society, like they have some control over the change that's happening.
So this is what you talk about, you refer to as normally charisma as a speaking style, right? That's obvious sort of what's going on. But charisma as part of this new leader-follower relationship will gain more followers if we adopt this new way, if we try to connect with people emotionally as well as through the power of the reason behind our arguments.
Right, exactly. And one of the points that I make is that charisma as a relationship goes both ways. So followers, we assume that the only way that ordinary people can influence, you know, their government is by having positions on issues and voting according to those issues. But in fact, these followers are responding to the emotions that the leaders are putting out there, and they're responding by basically siding with the leader that appeals the most to them. And so if you are a public speaker, all of a sudden, if you don't have the proper emotional appeal to the mass of voters, you're not going to win. Your movement doesn't work. It doesn't go anywhere. And so the followers are really in the driver's seat here. They have the ability to shape these movements and to decide what leaders become powerful based on who they side with.
Oh, okay. So that's in that way, it's sort of like this new, I don't want to say style, but this new avenue through which followers and voters and parishioners, all the people can sort of, if you will, vote democratically. We like so-and-so because he connects with us emotionally, in addition to the fact that we agree with him. We can see him as a human.
Exactly. And some of these voters, I mean, sometimes they'll say, yeah, I'm voting for William Jennings Bryan because he is, you know, I agree with his issues. But sometimes they'll say, I'm voting for William Jennings Bryan because I had a dream that he came into my house and gave me a bunch of silver. And that's, you know, that's an emotional reaction. It's not a logical, rational reaction, but a vote is still a vote, no matter where it comes from.
That's absolutely fascinating. Are there other things going on? It's not just cultural influences. Are there bigger things going on in the culture or in society that help explain why this is such a major phenomenon?
So one of the things that is happening is that there's a change in how people view democracy and how they view the relationship between ordinary people and their government. So there are a lot of people at the beginning of this time period in the 1870s and 80s who think that charisma is dangerous because people should vote based on logic and rationality. And what happens around the turn of the century, around the late 1890s and early 1900s, is that most Americans come to the conclusion that no, people don't necessarily vote according to reason, and they shouldn't necessarily vote according to reason. That people should have a role to play in their society just based on their emotional connection with leaders. And so this sort of discussion about what it means to be a democracy, what it means to have ordinary people involved in government, really takes center stage in this time period.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, let's take a break. What I get emotional about is when I don't shave with my Harry's razor. So let's take a break and get an ad from them, because they're, of course, one of our big sponsors. So we'll be back in a minute, Buzzkillers. You know that Harry's Razors sponsors this podcast, but did you also know that they're a great sponsor of Charisma? In fact, Without Harry's razors, none of the people we're going to talk about in this show, Teddy Roosevelt, Billy Sunday, William Jennings Bryan, any of those famous orators, would have been as successful and convincing as they were without Harry's razors. Because Harry's five-blade razors have the soft flex hinge for more comfortable glide. They have the lubricating strip, which works fantastically. Trimmer blade that Lincoln used when he needed to trim that famous beard. And a textured handle for more control. I became a Harry's customer a long time ago because rip-off razor companies were always charging a fortune and increasing their prices every year. Harry's doesn't do that. Harry's doesn't believe in upcharging. They bought their own factory in Germany where they make the blades. They make them themselves. They make them better and better, and their prices of rate remain the same. The good buzzkillers at Harry's Razors mail them right to you on a regular schedule that you set up with your membership, and they have a special offer for you. Only you, the buzzkillers of this world. They'll send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. Free trial set has a razor, five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel, and you just pay a tiny amount for the shipping. Plus, just for my listeners, just for you buzzkillers, you enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout, and you'll get their post-shave balm for free. Another free thing. Post-shave balm is great. Lady Buzzkill is great. All the women in the lives of all these men we're talking about loved it. You'll look better and your face will feel better all day when you use it. Of course, your plan is customizable. Of course, you can change the shipping frequency as often as you want, and you can cancel at any time. Go to harrys.com, enter the code BUZZKILL, two Z's, two L's. You'll get a great razor, great blades, great shave cream, great post-shave balm for free. Do it now. Start enjoying a whole new world of better and more affordable shaves. You'll look better, and your face will thank you for it. Harrys.com, code at checkout, BUZZKILL. Now back upstairs. All right, and we're back here in the research department, the broadcasting department of the Institute. Professor, let's go through a few of these famous charismatic leaders, movers and shakers, if you will, and let's introduce the buzzkillers, first of all, the ones they may not know about, but also explain how this development, this rise of charisma and an emphasis on magnetism and emotion worked in each one of them. For instance, in early, very important 19th century person, Henry Ward Beecher.
Right. Henry Ward Beecher was the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who's probably most famous for writing Uncle Tom's Cabin. Beecher was actually a member of a large family of ministers. His father was a famous minister. He had eight or nine brothers who were all ministers as well. But Henry Ward was the most famous of the ministers, more famous than any of his siblings except for Harriet. And what's interesting about Henry is he was the minister who the kid who wasn't expected to become a minister because he had a speech impediment. His father wasn't happy about that because he wanted all of his sons to become ministers. And you know, how are you going to be a minister if you can't preach?
Right.
So Beecher went to Amherst College when he was 12 years old, as people often did at the time. And the speech teacher at Amherst College sat him down with this James Rush textbook and basically said, you're going to practice this technique for 3 hours a day, every day for the next 3 years, and then you will become a good speaker and you'll get over your speech impediment.
3 hours a day?
Every day, 3 years.
That would ruin a kid's social life.
Oh, yes.
You'd be a great teacher, but no friends.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what happened was, not only did he overcome his speech impediment, but he became the most accomplished speaker in history using this technique. He got to the point where he was practicing it so much that not only could he use the technique reliably when he was giving speeches, but he actually could use it on the fly. He could speak extemporaneously using these emotional techniques. And he gave these incredible speeches that nobody had ever heard before. Mm-hmm. He could go into a room and just electrify everyone. He was primarily known for speaking against slavery, both before and during the Civil War.
Right.
And after the Civil War, he was known for some more scandalous things. Namely, he had a tendency to seduce his assistant minister's wives using his personal magnetism, his charisma.
Talk about emotion, yeah.
Right. And so he did this twice, actually. And the second time he seduced Elizabeth Tilton, the wife of Theodore Tilton. And Theodore Tilton got mad and decided he wasn't just going to take this laying down. And he sues Beecher in court for basically having kidnapped and spirited his wife away. And it's very interesting because there's some concern at first in the trial that Beecher is going to get convicted because people just assume that someone with that kind of charisma can't possibly refrain from seducing women.
Yeah.
But then ultimately he gets off because he seduces the jury, not sexually, but he basically uses charismatic oratory to manipulate them into believing that he's innocent, and it's a hung jury. And he goes free.
Well, often in movies and even in TV shows in the first half of the 20th century, eventually TV shows, you'll have these great oratorical closing arguments by the defense lawyer, and he gets all emotional, and you know, whoever it is gets off because of the great charisma of
he's defense doing his lawyer. Very own Mason impression before.
So how does this? Well, okay, so he's obviously a preacher, but as you make so clear in the book, the same sort of techniques, as you mentioned before too, the same sort of techniques are used by politicians and by, you know, labor leaders. I mean, one of the most famous that I think a lot of buzzkillers will know would be William Jennings Bryan.
Right. And William Jennings Bryan he may not be the most accomplished speaker in this charismatic style, but he definitely gives the most famous speech in this style.
Yeah.
He's a former two-term congressman from Nebraska, not even a current office holder in the 1896 election.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know. I thought he had just assumed he was in Congress. Okay.
Oh, he'd been defeated in 1894, so he was out of office. He shows up at the Democratic National Convention. Now, he's there to run for president, but as we've talked about, you aren't supposed to campaign for president at this time. So even the fact that he shows up at the convention is considered to be kind of a scandal. At the time, the Democrats don't have a very good candidate to run for president. Probably their leading candidate is a guy named Richard Bland, who catches his name very well. And Bryan stands up and he gives this speech about free silver, this currency issue that was very much on the mind of farmers at the time. And he gives this he uses these techniques, and he says, you know, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. And when he's done speaking, the audience is just absolutely silent. There's 20,000 people in the room. And then something happens that nobody has ever seen before in American history. Basically, the crowd just loses it. They just start screaming for him. They give him a standing ovation that lasts for 30 minutes.
You're kidding.
And they drag him off the stage, carry him around the entire convention center on their shoulders. It's the size of a football field. And when they're done, they basically nominate him for president by acclaim. He's 36 years old. He's not a current office holder, not even considered a serious candidate for the presidency. And he gives this speech, and he's the presidential nominee. And he comes within 4 points of winning the presidency in November.
You mean 4 electoral votes?
Four popular vote points.
Oh, wow, 4%. Okay, that's amazing.
And what's interesting is there are a lot of Democrats who are uncomfortable with him. He's viewed as sort of extreme on some issues. And so he doesn't get a lot of money. He actually is his opponent, William McKinley, who ultimately wins the election, has 5 times as much money as Bryan does.
Yeah.
And Bryan makes up for it by going all around the country and speaking to audiences directly on a special train. He travels for 3 months and he gives 500 speeches, which if you're counting is 6 speeches a day, day.
Is this a kind of whistle stop situation, an early version of the whistle stop tour?
Exactly. So 1 or 2 of those speeches per day will be in a rented hall, but the rest of them are going to be on the back platform of his train. And he just travels to towns and there will be a crowd waiting there for his train. And the train will stop. He'll get out. He'll say a few paragraphs. He'll leave. And people are just astounded by this because no one has ever campaigned for office before for the presidency. And if they have, it hasn't gone the way that it has with Bryan. Bryan has this kind of electric, magnetic personality that nobody else has had. And ultimately, while he doesn't win the presidency, he changes the way presidential candidates are run forever, because William McKinley realizes that he has to compete with this somehow, that he's just going to lose if he doesn't figure out some way to respond to what Brian's doing. He doesn't go out and give a speaking tour. He says that doing that, competing against Brian, would be about as useful as him trying to compete against a trapeze artist on the trapeze. but what he does is he gives a bunch of speeches on his front porch of his house, and then he uses all of that money that he has to send printed copies of those speeches around to voters all around the country. And so he's still campaigning. He's not doing the same thing that Brian's doing, but he's campaigning for office, something that people just haven't done before this. And ever after, really, it's impossible for people to run for president without campaigning in some way.
So would it be too much to say that Brian made up this gap in money, anyway, purely through his oratorical skills and this, you know, charismatic magnetism?
No, I think that's the primary thing that he does. I mean, he does have some issue positions that are pretty popular on things like free silver and the tariff, but really it's about his personality. It's about the way that people connect with him.
Now, and we have a recording of Brian giving at least part of this Cross of Gold speech, right? It's famous in American history as the Cross of Gold speech, and everyone who's had history class or history major would know. But before we play it, can you sort of set it up for us? A, remind the Buzzkillers what the bimetallism and the gold standard and all that sort of thing what was about in terms of an issue, but then also where this recording comes from and how it's made, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. So bimetallism, oh man, the gold standard. I tell my students the toughest concept we're going to learn all year. So the short version of it is basically there is only a certain amount of paper money that's being printed tied to the amount of gold in the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
And businessmen believe that keeping the amount of paper money in circulation tied to the amount of gold in the Treasury is absolutely necessary to keep the economy going and to keep free trade going globally. And farmers think that it is starving them. And that they need to print more money or the farmers will all go out of business.
Right.
So it becomes a sort of existential battle between farmers and businessmen over whether or not they should print more money. And ultimately, Franklin Roosevelt, 40 years later, decides to just print all the money we need and it doesn't crash the economy and that's what we do ever after. But that's what they're arguing about in this when he's talking about bimetallism.
And Brian,
bimetallism, go ahead.
Brian is on the side of the farmers, or at least not being completely tied to gold.
Right. Brian is on the side of a compromise that farmers are advocating for, where they tie the amount of money in circulation to the amount of gold and silver in the Treasury, which would be basically a one-time infusion of money into the system, which would help this generation of farmers, but maybe not solve the whole problem permanently. Now, the thing to understand about this recording is it was not made in 1896 when Brian was 36 years old and standing up at the convention. He made this recording as an older man. He made it 27 years later in 1923 in a recording studio. And it's still pretty powerful to listen to him speak, but you just have to sort of imagine yourself 27 years later. Imagine this guy who, you know, is not in good health by the time he gives the speech. Imagine him as a young man giving the speech to an electrified crowd of 20,000 people, and you'll get a sense of just how emotionally impactful this speech was.
Okay, Buzzkillers, here it is.
We care not upon what line the battle is fought. If they say bimetallism is good, but that we cannot have it until other nations help us, we reply that instead of having a gold standard, because England has, we will restore bimetallism. And then let England have bimetallism because the United States has. If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we will fight them to the uttermost. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
All right, and we're back. Would it be fair to say, Professor, that although he's much, much older, that he's still using the same technique, the same sort of rhetorical approach, the same sort of delivery style as an older man as he would in his 30s?
Absolutely. This is a textbook example of the James Rush speaking style. It has three really important features that distinguish it from modern political speech. The first is what's called an expanded pitch range. The highs are higher and the lows are lower than you would expect in normal speech. So you shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
Oh, yeah, that's got my heart going.
Right. I mean, it doesn't have the same effect on modern audiences, obviously, that it did on people at the time. But at the time, this is the way actors spoke. This is the way people were accustomed to hearing great speakers speak. And so it was really emotionally affecting for them. The second thing that they do is what Rush called the melody of speech, basically speaking in a poetic or sing-song way. And it's interesting if you know anything about poetry and poetic meters, the famous line, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold," is perfect iambic hexameter.
Oh, okay.
And finally, and this is probably the thing you notice the most, Rush invented this technique which he called the orotund voice, which is basically the way that opera singers sing. They lower their voice box to make a much bigger and rounder and richer tone. And you can actually make that tone while speaking if you train yourself to do it, and that's what Brian did. "You shall not crucify mankind." And that rich speaking tone allowed his voice to carry to an audience of 20,000 without a microphone. This is mass media before the invention of mass media. There's no electronic amplification at all, and he's able to be heard, according to rumor, he could be heard at a distance of 2 miles.
Really? Was there anything about the technique that sort of saved your voice, made it possible for you to do this, for instance, as Brian did 6 times a day?
No, I think that people did get hoarse doing this. Right. Brian had a pretty incredible instrument. You know, he would have made a good opera singer.
Oh, okay. Now, before we have a couple of other people to talk about, but what one thing sort of jumped into my mind here. Is there also – there's obviously a change in style and there's a change in vocalization and change in things in those sorts of things, the physical things. Are speeches written differently? You're sort of implying that they are. Were speeches written differently in order to, you know, cater to this style, in order to make them more magnetic and more attractive to audiences? In other words, the printed speeches McKinley's sending out might be super boring, except that that's the way things were. And did Brian send out more exciting speeches, the printed versions – that, you know, to be read?
So in theory, and Brian does print up his speeches just like McKinley does. He doesn't get the kind of play from that McKinley does, because people are more interested in hearing him speak. Yeah. But the main difference, I would say, is not with with someone like McKinley. It's a difference with this earlier speaking style, with people who were learning to speak from listening to Cicero. Because there were these people who assumed that you had to speak in this incredibly flowery style, which is the way that those Greek and Roman models looked in their translations. And so they used all this flowery language. There's a famous speech by Robert Ingersoll, who was probably one of the best speakers in that older style, where he calls somebody a plumed knight and a knight errant of the new chivalry, and he put his lance out full and fair against everyone who tried to blacken his honor. And that kind of language gets dropped, and it's a little more like ordinary people would speak, not fully how ordinary people would speak. Ordinary people don't say "you shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold," but it is moving in that direction.
Okay. Well, certainly perhaps the most ordinary, although maybe not ordinary, but the most popular or the most filmed person was a man named Billy Sunday, who we're going back now to the religious end of things, not the political end of things. He not only appears on the cover of your book, he actually stands on top of lecterns or maybe specially built platforms to sort of act out his speeches. Now, I should remind the Buzzkillers, Billy Sunday started life as a baseball player, and when I was a kid, I used to be obsessed with baseball history, so I learned a little bit about him. But you illuminate us so much more in your book.
I'm a big baseball fan, too, so I enjoyed part of Billy Sunday's career. And Billy Sunday, as a baseball player, was known for being a base stealer. He was known for being fast, and very athletic and physical. And he uses that a lot in his sermons. So he converts the most people really in the of any evangelist in American history from the 1820s all the way until Billy Graham shows up in the 1940s and 50s. Sunday, it's interesting because he didn't have a college education. He took one college class in his entire life, and guess what? It was a class in James Rush style public speaking. But he's not a great speaker there. If you listen to him speak, and I think we'll listen to him in a minute.
Yeah.
He speaks he has a very raspy voice. He's hard to understand. There are people who go to his sermons and say that they don't have any idea what he's saying because he talks so quickly. He's most famous in his speeches for telling stories, for talking about his baseball career. He has this great story about how he's gonna catch a ball in the outfield and the ball is really far away, and he prays to God, please God, let me catch this ball, and if you do, I'll give up my career and become an evangelist. And then he gets to catch the ball. A historian has since proven that while he did make one of those famous catches, he didn't quit baseball for another year.
Oh, okay.
And so, that's a story. He also has this great story where he'll bring out a bunch of vases, and then he'll shatter them. He'll say, these are the deadly sins. And we're going to, shatter them to represent all the sins that you are all committing. And those stories stick in people's minds. But what really sticks in people's minds is the way that he sets it up. He has advance agents come to town 6 weeks before he's going to come into town and give a sermon. He has a musical performance, him sing, that goes for up to 90 minutes before he even takes the stage, which really gets people emotionally prepared for these sermons. Then he gives the sermon, and then after he gives the sermon, he invites you to come down and what he calls hit the sawdust trail. There's sawdust on the ground in these tabernacles where he's preaching, and he says, hit the sawdust trail and pledge yourself to Christ and come up and shake my hand. And he stands in the middle, and these handshakes are a very important part of the charismatic process. He stands in the middle of the tabernacle, and people come up to him in the thousands, and they shake his hand, and they get literature. And they're converted. Uh-huh. And he does this really for about 30 years nonstop.
Wow. We have a YouTube clip. We're going to take the audio from it, which Billy Sunday, look it up on YouTube, Buzzkillers, because you can see him pacing back and forth, or forward and back, I should say. And he talks about this wicked old world, but he also talks about temperance and avoiding alcohol and how alcohol in his mind makes you an ungodly person.
Right. And his crusade against alcohol, the most famous part of Billy Sunday's campaign, he was a leading figure promoting prohibition. Mm-hmm. And there is some evidence to indicate that when he gave a sermon in a particular city, votes for prohibition would go up. So there were these local prohibition ordinances, statewide prohibition ordinances, and he'd go preach. And then a place like Detroit would vote for prohibition after he had been preaching there.
Well, you can hear his passion in this audio clip.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am the sworn, eternal, uncompromising enemy of the liquor traffic. I ask no quarter and I give none. What means this assault against the 18th Amendment? Oh, it's nothing under heaven but an attempt to bind and rivet the old breweries and the old distilleries around the neck of the American people for their own profit. But where will the money come from? They say that Uncle Sam will pay Uncle Sam $1,500,000,000 in revenue. Well, where will it come from? Come from the pocket of the poor devil that drinks the stuff in the world. They say we need their saloons in order to bring back prosperity. Well, what does Germany need and France and England to bring prosperity? Why don't they pay us what they owe us? They say, well, prohibition has brought on the depression. Well, what's brought on the world? Their depression is worldwide. The saloons are dead as an Egyptian mummy. She's too dead to skin. But her ghost hangs like a moral paralysis over our land. But no man, woman, or child alive today will ever live to see the stars and stripes wave over an open licensed saloon in the United States, my friend of America. I'll fight the saloon from Hawaii to Hoboken. I'll kick it as long as I have a foot. I'll punch it as long as I have a fist. I'll butt it as long as I have a head. I'll bite it as long as I have a tooth. And when I'm old and fistless and footless and toothless, I'll gob it till I go home to heaven and it goes home up into hell.
Okay, well, how about that? Anyone feel like giving up drink? And so he does this for a very, very long time. Are there ways in which we can sort of measure the success of speaking and rhetoric in terms of politicians? But does Billy Sunday, you know, he converts an awful lot of people. Are there any numbers on this that we know of?
He claims to have converted 1 million people. He claims 10 million attendees and 1 million converts. The more accurate numbers that we have, somewhere in the range of maybe 200,000 converts.
Right.
But that's still a huge number.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
You don't see numbers like that again until Billy Graham.
Right. 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 And then, of course, Billy Graham is all amplified and everything else. He has all the advantages of modern technology and cameras.
And the other thing is the people that many of the people that Sunday converts go out and convert other people. So there's a bank president named Lucius A. Eddy who, after he's converted, goes out and converts 4,000 more people. There's a famous minister in New York, William Ward Ayer, who was converted by Sunday and then went on to convert thousands more throughout his career. So it's not, you know, there's these sort of secondary effects that happen as well.
Okay, and you might imagine, Buzzkillers, that this technique and this sort of style and the belief in this technique and style is taken up by a lot of agitators or a lot of reformers. I'm particularly impressed with the ways in which you explain how Eugene Debs, the great labor organizer and union organizer, went about attracting followers this way.
Debs is a one of the people that I talk about who actually didn't study this style in college. He learns his charismatic style basically from watching other people use it.
I see. Okay. That's what I must have gotten wrong.
In the Democratic Party when Brian is around and he picks up on it from others. But yeah, he goes out and Debs starts life actually as a Democratic politician and as a labor leader, and he ends up as the most effective socialist candidate in American history, mm-hmm. except for some guy named Bernie Sanders.
Oh, that guy, yeah.
Yeah, that guy. I don't know if Buzzkillers have heard of him. Yeah. But yeah,
I don't think he used I don't think he used the. I don't think Bernie used the James Rush style.
No, he didn't. and Debs, he runs for president in 5 separate elections between 1900 and 1920. The most he ever gets is 6%. But that's a pretty significant amount for a party candidate. Yeah. And he is best known in his use of this style for his handshakes. People talk about how soft his hands are, which sounds like a strange thing to say about a presidential candidate. Oh, I love this guy. His hands are so soft.
But
people, it's interesting. People listen to him speak, and then they shake his hand, and they feel like they are somehow directly connected to him, and they become converts to socialism in the same way that Billy Sunday followers become converts to Billy Sunday's version of Christianity.
Oh, so they become converts to socialism, which is in theory a very cut-and-dried economic ideology through the personal magnetism of Eugene Debs.
Exactly.
So they don't necessarily have to buy the argument. They believe in Eugene Debs.
I mean, the belief in the argument comes later, and there's a lot of research out that says that people decide, you know, what their political beliefs are going to be based on these sort of emotional cues, and then they come up with rationalizations after the fact. And there's a lot of that going on here as well.
But and one thing that astounds me so much is we talk about these four speakers is morality, and sort of, you know, these two of them are based on preaching and some of them are based on moral politics. It seems fascinating that those two connections weren't made back in Lincoln's day or back in Jackson's day or even back in Founding Fathers' day.
Right, and I think that, of course, it's worth remembering that Henry Ward Beecher was known for immorality.
Oh, but yeah, that's right. Yeah, but I mean, he's at least preaching morality.
Right,
even
exactly.
Even he's not practicing it.
And both of those things, I think, are very, very, you know, you can use emotions to sell morality and you can use emotions to sell a political platform very effectively.
Right. Okay. Well, this is probably a good time to take a break and hear from our partners at Eco Soap Bank because they're doing highly moral and highly important work in Cambodia. Back in a minute. Well, Skillers, are you aware that global hygiene is in your hands? The people at Eco Soap Bank are aware of it. Clean water, proper sanitation, and personal cleanliness are among the most important factors in keeping poor families healthy in the developing world. Yet, 75% of rural families in Cambodia lack access to the most basic hygiene products, including soap. So Eco Soap Bank is doing something about it. They partner with hotels and guest houses in Cambodia to collect the partially used bars of soap left behind by the estimated 3 to 4 million tourists that pass through that country each year. The discarded, non-biodegradable bars are purified and recycled into new soap bars that are then distributed to rural schools, clinics, and slum areas. To date, The Eco Soap Bank has recycled 26,000 pounds of soap and served 667,000 people through its distribution program and its hygiene classes. The Buzzkill Institute is committed to helping this great project by contributing $1 for every Buzzkiller who donates to the Eco Soap Bank. Go to ecosoapbank.org/donate and type Buzzkill, two Z's and two L's, in the comments section of the online donation form. A donation of just $25 provides soap and hygiene education for 250 Cambodians, recycles 35 pounds of soap from the hospitality industry, and it supports ongoing employment of local people in Cambodia. It's as easy as that, Buzzkillers. A simple act to fill a basic need. Okay, we're back with Professor Young talking about the age of charisma and the importance of charisma and the new ways in which charisma is changing people's mind and working in politics and all sorts of other ways. We haven't talked, Professor, about the two biggies, Teddy Roosevelt on the one hand and also Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
Can we start about TR's adoption and use of this new charismatic style?
One of the most, I think, controversial things that I found doing my research is that Teddy Roosevelt actually wasn't exactly all that charismatic of a speaker.
Oh, you would think he would be with a big chest and the bully this and bully that. And
yes, you would.
The bully pulpit.
But Teddy, here's the thing. There, a graduate student named William Auburn Bell did a research project on this in 1940. He interviewed a bunch of people who had listened to Teddy Roosevelt speak and asked them, you know, what kind of a speaker is he? And they basically said, you know, he was fine. He was engaging. People liked him. He wasn't like Brian.
Oh, I see. And it's amazing that they actually specifically mentioned Brian. They say he wasn't like Brian.
Yes, yeah. They say, no, he wasn't like that. And it turns out that Teddy Roosevelt he didn't actually have training in the Rush style of public speaking. Mm-hmm. And he developed a very unique style of public speaking. And this is what he did. He would write out his speeches paragraph by paragraph or type them out on half sheets of paper. And he would read the paragraph, which was generally pretty boring.
Yeah.
And then he would drop the piece of paper and it would be picked up by souvenir hunters in the audience. And then he would just kind of riff on the thing that he talked about in the paragraph for a few minutes. And then he turned to the next paragraph. And those extemporaneous riffs, that's where he connected with the audience. He did have a good connection with the audience, but it wasn't the printed speech. It was just the sort of things that he was saying when he wasn't reading off the page.
And did he adopt a sort of physical style or physical movements or gestures, anything like Sunday or Brian?
Yeah, he has a pretty over-the-top gestural style. In that way, he's similar to you see these famous photos of him sort of you know, pounding his finger in people's faces. And he was also known actually for you know, when he got really excited, his voice would go really high and squeaky and not sound very good.
And that doesn't sound like the guy who goes, you know, wild game hunting in Africa to have the high and squeaky voice.
And the other thing is, when he got really excited, he would clack his teeth.
Oh.
And so you see all those photos or those cartoons of Teddy Roosevelt with giant teeth.
Yeah.
It's not because he had a face with giant teeth. It's because when he would speak and he'd get really excited, he would clack his teeth.
Oh.
It'd sound really weird.
It would sound weird, but presumably after the first 10 rows back, you wouldn't hear that.
Right. Well, yeah, I think that's true, but people thought he was a good speaker, but you kind of had to be there. Reading his speeches didn't give you the experience of listening to him, because the good stuff was when he wasn't reading what was on the printed page.
Well, so we have a couple of recordings here from Teddy Roosevelt, some audio. Can you set those up for us? Those were obviously not recorded again out on the stump, but how do they work? Were they recorded later? Were they recorded at 1912?
Right. So you're going to listen to a recording. This was made in 1912 of Theodore Roosevelt speaking. He basically giving a speech that he would give on the campaign trail, but in this case, he's giving it at a recording studio. And the way that these speeches worked this early in the recording process, he's basically going up to what looks like a Victrola, you know, that big bulb.
Right,
the trumpet. And sticking his face in it and just shouting as loud as he possibly can. And then the recording will be sort of quiet. The one you're listening to was remastered, but the original recording, very quiet. And so, you know, you're only getting a certain sense of what he sounded like. You can kind of get what he sounded like, but it's not quite the same thing as if you were hearing him.
Okay, here we go. Teddy Roosevelt himself.
The great fundamental issue now before our people can be stated briefly. It is, or are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not. I believe in the right of the people to rule. I believe that the majority of the plain people of the United States will, day in and day out, make fewer mistakes in governing themselves than any smaller class or body of men, no matter what their training, will make in trying to govern them. I believe again that the American people are, as a whole, capable of self-control and of learning by their mistakes. Our opponents pay lip loyalty to this doctrine, but they show their real beliefs by the way in which they champion every device to make the nominal rule of the people a sham. I am not leading this fight as a matter of aesthetic pleasure. I am leading because somebody must lead, or else the fight would not be made at all. I prefer to work with moderate, with rational conservatives, provided only that they do in good faith strive forward toward the light. But when they halt and turn their backs to the light, sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them. We, the people, cannot turn back.
And one of the interesting points you make is that he seems to, in the election of 1912, when he comes back, right, he seems to pay more attention to adopting a more charismatic style than before. He seems to have bought into this in order to try to win as a third party candidate.
Right, because he has no organization. There are no newspapers supporting him. There's no money, and he really has to rely on charisma in the way that Bryan did in order to win. And it goes horribly wrong.
Well, sorry, 1 second, Professor. We should remind the Buzzkillers that of the electoral chronology here. Roosevelt had already been president, so what's happening in 1912 that makes him want to run again?
He doesn't like what his successor as president, William Howard Taft, is doing. He feels that Taft is not really governing as a progressive and is being too conservative, firing Teddy Roosevelt's friends who are still in the cabinet. And Roosevelt decides that he's going to run against him. He runs in the primary against him as a Republican, and Taft wins. And then Roosevelt strikes out on his own, runs as a third-party progressive candidate, and tries to win that way.
And this is the last time that a president has sort of tried to run again after his two terms are up or something like that, right? Isn't it? I mean, Grover Cleveland did it, but did someone else do it?
Franklin Roosevelt, of course, and ran and served four terms.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, there's no break in the middle like there is with Roosevelt. Right, okay.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's another time when a president has tried to come back after losing office.
So why does he think in 1912 he better become more charismatic?
Because he thinks that he doesn't have any newspapers supporting him as a third-party candidate. He doesn't have a lot of money. He doesn't have the sort of institutional support that major party candidates have. And so he wants to rely on charisma in the way that Bryan did and see if it'll put him over the top.
Okay. And obviously it doesn't work.
No, it goes horribly wrong because his handlers and Roosevelt himself fail to understand that in order to connect charismatically with an audience, you have to be there. You have to be there in person. You have to talk to as many people as you possibly can. His handlers decide that instead of talking to 500, 600 audiences, he should just go around the country and give speeches so that they'll be printed for free in the newspapers and he can get free advertising that way. And that is not an effective charismatic technique. And it's particularly ineffective for TR because TR's printed speeches aren't much to write home about. It's the in-person experience that really does it for him.
So in a way, he wants to adopt this charismatic style, but he's using the old-fashioned version of political logistics. He goes out to smaller places and relies on newspapers, which is what presumably Lincoln did.
Exactly. There's this great moment when Hiram Johnson, the vice presidential candidate for Roosevelt, storms into the campaign office and pounds his fist on the desk and says, "You guys are doing this wrong. I know how to run a charismatic campaign. Roosevelt needs to be speaking to more audiences." And the campaign secretary says, "No, you're doing it wrong because you're speaking to too many audiences and not trying to get your words in the newspaper."
Fascinating. And obviously, he loses. And he loses to Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, he does.
And then things change again, as you point out in the book.
Right. So Woodrow Wilson is a very interesting case when it comes to public speaking. He's a guy who is a very accomplished speaker, but doesn't really believe in charisma because he thinks that you should just appeal to people using the sort of conviction of your morality and your reason, and not try to manipulate their emotions. He goes and hears Henry Ward Beecher speak, and he says, "Ugh, it's all sound and fury, and there's no point. There's no reason there."
But things must have been changing enough, because after all, he wins, and you know, the age of charisma and the age of this sort of type of speaking seems to be on the way out by the teens and 20s. Am I right about that? I mean, I'm right about him winning, but is it fading out?
I would say it's not fading until after World War I, but I would say that Wilson is already looking forward to a time when charisma is going to be less important. What's interesting is that Wilson ends up resorting to charismatic techniques himself late in his presidency, when he comes back from after the war is over, he comes back from the Paris Peace Conference with the other allies, trying to decide, you know, what's going to happen to Germany. And Wilson has convinced the allies to adopt a League of Nations, in his view, people are going to get together and, you know, work out their disputes before they resort to war. And Wilson comes back, tries to sell this to the Congress. Congress doesn't want it. Congress doesn't want us to be part of a League of Nations. They feel like we're going to be dragged into wars that we don't want anything to do with. And so Wilson decides to go out and give a charismatic speaking tour and try to convince voters to force their senators to vote for the League of Nations.
But is he not – he doesn't have enough experience with it? He's not good enough? Or is it just people are becoming xenophobic and isolationist after the war?
Well, at first he's not very good at it. There's a cartoon where these – commentators joke, it's not a true story, but they joke that Wilson was on a platform next to a pitcher of ice water and no one could tell which one was the ice water and which one was the president. But eventually he gets better at it and he begins to give these really charismatic speeches, and then he has a massive stroke and collapses and is not able to continue.
Yeah, well, that's just strokes intervene, as they say. But the other thing I thought was so fascinating about the final chapters in your book is you talk about how FDR actually plays a big role in this. And, you know, FDR is not elected to 32. So if the age of charisma is passing after Wilson, it certainly takes a long time to pass. How does FDR change the rhetorical approach?
So the thing that causes charisma to disappear, at least the version of charisma that is that speaking style that you heard on those recordings, the thing that causes it to change is basically the radio. It turns out that does not sound very good over the radio. You kind of have to be there in order to really appreciate it. And so in 1924, for instance, Calvin Coolidge who's the sitting president running for re-election, gives a bunch of radio speeches, and Calvin Coolidge is the worst speaker in American history. He speaks like through this nasal twang, and he just reads his speeches off of a piece of paper, and it's terrible. And over the radio, it sounds great because it sounds calm and measured. Running against him in that race, he's running against a couple of candidates, but one of them is a third party candidate named Robert La Follette, who is using the charismatic speaking style. And it just doesn't work for him. He, for one thing, he goes on and on and on and on for like 3 hours in a 1 hour time slot, because you can do that if you've got an audience spellbound, but you can't do that in a 1 hour radio slot.
Yeah.
And he also the other problem that he has is that he moves around so much that he can't stand in front of the microphone. So at one point he had to have his son stand behind him and hold his coat so that he wouldn't move out of microphone range.
And presumably, people have radios in their homes. They don't want people shouting in their homes. And if
exactly, you know. It sounds, you know, you're sitting around listening to a radio, you don't want somebody shouting at you. It sounds like the guy has kind of lost it if he's giving that kind of speech over the radio. So Franklin Roosevelt figures out how to use the radio to really appear to people in their living rooms. Mm-hmm. He gives these famous fireside chats. He comes into your living room. He just sits down with you and he explains to you what's going on in the country. And he sounds like a calm, collected, fatherly figure who's just dropped by for a chat. And it has this incredible effect on people. The first fireside chat in March 11th, 1933, excuse me, March 13th, 1933, is or no, March 12th.
Yeah, we can't get those dates so wildly wrong.
No, I know, I'm all over the place. So he sits down, he gives this fireside chat, and it is probably has about as much emotional effect on people as Brian's Cross of Gold speech did. It's
a new thing.
Okay. He's never heard this before. Somebody writes to him and says, you know, before today, the president of the United States was just a newspaper item to me, but you are real.
Yeah, that's very powerful.
It felt to people as though he was even closer to them emotionally than charismatic speakers were, but he wasn't doing it with emotion. He was doing it, he was doing it with emotion, but it wasn't with this sort of over the top, over emotional, overwrought approach. Instead, he's speaking very conversationally, just sort of coming to them and speaking to them as a friend would.
Right, and it stays that way through Truman and Eisenhower and
up until the present day.
Right, basically. Right. Fascinating. So media helps change it as much as almost anything else.
Right.
The type of media that's being used to deliver the message.
Right. And so what I like to say is that as a speaking style, charisma is over, right? We don't listen to speakers who sound like William Jennings Bryan anymore. It sounds strange to us. But what remains of the age of charisma is this relationship between leaders and followers. Today, we expect our leaders to shake hands and kiss babies and give speeches and talk to us, even people who aren't good at it. You can't run for president without trying to give something of yourself emotionally to the voters.
Right.
And that wasn't true before the age of charisma. So that, I think, is the lasting legacy. That is how our democracy works. We demand something emotionally of our leaders.
And in this case, it's very personal, often very, very close contact, kissing babies and all that stuff.
Right. And, you know, showing up on our televisions, coming into our living rooms, just like FDR did.
Well, Buzzkillers, I was absolutely gripped by the book, and I was absolutely gripped by the listening to you in this episode, Professor. And I want to remind the Buzzkillers, of course, we've put The Age of Charisma, Professor Young's new book, on the Buzzkill bookshelf for you to get. And we like to ask professors when we interview them over the interwebs, what are you working on now? What can we interview you about next?
Ooh, well, at the moment, I'm in the very early stages of working on a book about alternate realities in American history.
Uh-oh.
And much more about it than that, but it sounds like an interesting topic to me, so we'll see where it goes.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again so much for being on the show. And Buzzkillers, there you have it. The charismatic style waxes and wanes, but it's very, very important when it's working. Talk to you next week.